This podcast was recorded on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respect to their elders past and present. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are also advised that this episode may contain voices of people who are deceased.
There have been stories of bigger ones, but the crocs that we're looking at today are just as dangerous.
All right, let's go check out some crocs.
Eco-trauma cinema is all about a relationship of trauma between human protagonists and nature that kind of exceeds them.
Just because these are top predators, like many of the large animals, they're endangered or critically endangered.
A group of tourists visiting Australia's top end, a broken down boat, and one giant crocodile. That's the central plot of Rogue, a 2007 film from director Greg McLean. It follows the classic animal horror formula. Think Jaws, but set in Arnhem Land, and with a different kind of killer beast. American travel writer Pete McKell is on a reluctant assignment in outback Australia and steps aboard a crocodile sightseeing cruise along with a group of holidaymakers. When they spot a distress flare, the tour guide, Kate, insists on heading upstream to offer assistance. But things soon take a turn for the worse after a giant croc attacks the boat, leaving the group stranded on a small, muddy island with a fast rising tide. Together, they plot an escape as the killer croc attempts to pick them off, one by one. I'm Dylan Bird, and this is Seeing Green, a podcast exploring how Australian cinema has shaped our relationship to our natural environment. And just a heads up, there are a few little microphone sounds for one of our guests in this episode. The perils of recording remotely, unfortunately, but we don't think it's too distracting and we hope you don't mind either. In this episode, we're taking an up-close look at Rogue, exploring what the film reveals about our connection to nature. We'll touch on themes such as ecotourism and biodiversity conservation, and consider whether fantastical horror movies featuring killer beasts can serve a productive purpose in raising awareness about key environmental issues. And I'm joined in this endeavour by two experts from different fields. First up is our film expert, Dr. Simon Troon, a teaching associate and early career researcher based at Monash University in Melbourne. Hi, Simon. Great to have you here. Welcome.
Hello. It's great to be here.
And so tell us a bit about your research background.
So I'm a film and media scholar. I'm in the School of Media, Film and Journalism at Monash, where at the moment I'm helping out with several big research projects around media and the environment in Australia. In my own research, I'm interested in, I guess you'd say, popular imaginaries around the environment and how humans encounter and interact with the environment, all about trying to work toward more complex understandings of how films especially can reflect and represent human, non-human interaction and interrelation.
And so where does your interest in disaster film and the eco-horror genre and I suppose environmentally themed films in general come from?
It comes from actually, in a way, a pretty personal situation. I'm from Christchurch in New Zealand. We had an earthquake there about a decade ago, and at the time it was a real moment of sort of disjuncture where it was like the reality of the situation did not match up to the popular imaginary of what an earthquake would be like. So I started thinking about these things back then. It was a while before I came to do the research after that, but that's where it goes back to.
Well, we're very happy to have you as part of today's conversation. Thanks for being here. We're also joined today by Dr. Benjamin Thompson, a lecturer in human geography, also from Monash University, whose work spans diverse topics encompassing environmental management and nature-based solutions to climate change, among others. Ben, it's great to have you as part of today's discussion as well. Welcome.
Thanks, Dylan. Good to be here.
And so tell us about your line of work and what sorts of research projects you've done in the past.
My research touched on ecotourism, particularly the entrepreneurs that run ecotourism operations and some of the challenges that they face in meeting the supposed principles of ecotourism to obviously be, you know, environmentally sustainable and support local communities whilst trying to obviously generate profit to sustain their business economically. I've also done research on other aquatic animals beyond crocodiles, such as swordfish. Charismatic animal, done some research there in Bangladesh, And actually, in a former life, I've also run some nature tours in the Seychelles, particularly for tourists, pointing out chameleons and animals which are perhaps a little bit more friendly than the crocs.
I'm so glad to have you as part of the conversation in this episode and to draw on your expertise. Without further ado, let's sink our teeth into Rogue. Simon, how can we understand this film genre-wise?
Great question, and it's a really big question, I think. The film is very rich in the way that it embodies and kind of intersects with a number of genres. You mentioned eco-horror, and I think that that's probably the one for most people who watch the film that would, you know, all of the cliches and tropes of how horror movies sort of generate a reaction of fear, it does all of those. I think it's really worthwhile pointing out how it draws on monster movies. Monster movies are a massive tradition in popular cinema, going back to at least King Kong in the 30s. Greg McLean, the director, has said, I believe, that he was inspired by a creature from the Black Lagoon in his kind of conceiving of the film. And there's some pretty clear resonance there, I think. But I also think of all the sort of more theoretical, more critical formulations of genre, the one that I would align the film with is a genre or an idea of eco-trauma cinema, which is all about a relationship of trauma between human protagonists and nature that kind of exceeds them and is a violence to it in the way that they encounter it.
And what's another film as an example of that approach?
Gosh, look, I'm going to go ahead and say Jaws. I think it's got to be said. Jaws, but also films like Hitchcock, Birds, another Hitchcock film, Lifeboat, films where humans are sort of taken out into nature and become isolated.
And Ben, how did you go watching this film? It strikes me as funny in a way that we're taking it seriously, because it is a kind of schlop horror sort of movie. It's a bit of fun. I don't think it's necessarily, you know, a highbrow film or anything. With your background in things like environmental management, ecotourism and that sort of stuff, did you view this film through that lens when you came to watch it?
Yeah, absolutely. I personally don't watch too many horror movies. It's partly because I have a phobia of blood, so I was glad that there wasn't too much gore in Rogue. But yeah, I was particularly interested in the opening of the movie, perhaps before the, you know, the villainous crocodile arrives on the scene to observe how ecotourism operations and sort of bare bones ecotourism operations, as it seemed to be in this particular case, are portrayed in the movie.
Better you than me.
Okay, so one of the rules of my tour is that you have only one chance to complain about the heat and the flies. Nice to meet you. They're a fact of life up here, and whinging about them all day isn't going to make them disappear.
Everything from what the guide was saying, the feeding of the crocodiles, quite a common activity in ecotourism, to obviously draw animals to the boat in this case.
Well, let's dive into that idea of feeding crocodiles in the wild, because on the boat that the tourists are on, and the American travel writer Pete McCall is on, he's sort of there to write about the experience, you know, coming from America. On that actual boat, they're not feeding crocodiles, but at one point they pass by another boat that is. It's that classic jumping crocs tour that you see everywhere around Darwin. What do they do to the ecosystem? I mean, how are they viewed in terms of conservation and the impact they have on animals and the environment, Ben?
Well, crocodiles are what we would term an apex predator. They're sort of at the top of the food chain, and they play an important role in moderating the populations of the species which they eat, essentially. That's how the role these top predators perform in any ecosystem, whether it's tigers eating deer in the Sundarbans mangrove forest in Bangladesh, or crocodiles eating, you know, other fish species, etc., in the Northern Territories. So crocodiles play an important role, and it's worth remembering that just because these are top predators, like many other large animals, they're in many cases endangered or critically endangered. Some have been hunted, etc., but there's also issues going on with habitat loss, pollution, etc. All species are affected by these human-induced modes of environmental degradation. So important to note, actually, that on that particular boat tour, they weren't feeding the crocodiles, and we did only see one, I suppose, competitor feeding them.
Hey, what are they waiting for?
Keep watching.
Oh my gosh. What was that? Of course, the sort of knock-on effect of that is that it can affect the animals' foraging and feeding behaviour, possibly even their hunting behaviour. So there's, you know, scientific literature around that and around how big of an issue this is. And there's some debate on that, depending on, again, context, the species, and the scale of the ecotourism operation and just how much food is being provided for these wild animals by humans.
Yeah, interesting. And on that note about different species of crocodiles, we should be clear, I suppose, that Rogue is all about saltwater crocs, those that are larger and often more aggressive than their freshwater cousins. Both species now populate waterways in northern Australia in huge numbers, really, after being pretty close to extinction in the 1970s, but following government interventions to protect the species and ban hunting, populations have recovered really substantially. Simon, what's your sense of the significance of tourism to this film? Because, I mean, you know, a lot of people do go to the top end, especially to see crocodiles.
Really, it's part of the genre framing of the film. Tourism is the means by which this random assortment of people kind of come together and go on a journey. Films like this rely on mechanisms like that for bringing people together and putting them into this isolated context. An example would be something like the disaster movie Poseidon. A cruise liner capsizes in the middle of the ocean, and it's this group of people who ordinarily would not come together, and they're all different characters. They embody different national backgrounds, different class backgrounds, but they're all sort of thrown together into this very testing scenario against which each of their foibles and virtues are measured. It's a means of bringing this random group together.
It could come into the boat, right? It could come into the boat.
You'll be right, so long as you don't go in the water.
I'm not planning on it, I'll tell you that.
I suppose, as you sort of suggest as well, it provides an instant stereotype for us to read people through as well. We have the sort of lead character, I suppose, Pete McCall referred to, I think, as a bloody American at one point. There's the stereotypical sort of Irish character. There's some sort of British people as well on this holiday. So what about the role of the foreigner in these kinds of animal horror flicks and the idea of people being out of place in somewhere where perhaps they're not meant to be and perhaps aren't welcome? What's your sense of the significance of that in this film, Simon?
When you do have these groups of characters thrown together like this, and they do typify particular backgrounds and can have particular stereotypes attached to them, nature really functions as a means of, you know, seeing which one of these characters is best, which one of these characters has the qualities to survive and to overcome and command nature. So it's really curious to me that the character who does have those requisite qualities in this film is an American travel writer. I suppose it's not surprising that it's an American character, because that's, you know, if we're thinking about popular imaginaries, you know, a Hollywood hero is usually the one who does kind of triumph against all odds. But in an Australian film, in an Australian wilderness, where in Australia we have so many tropes and ideas of Australian characters who could, and we might think should, be the ones to sort of triumph and tame the wilderness, it's really curious to me that it's the American who does.
I thought you were supposed to be some kind of fearless travel writer.
Yeah, well, you know what? I just saw a man get eaten by a fucking crocodile. This is not what I do, all right? You know what I do? I write stupid articles about hotels and restaurants and resorts, not about the Australian outback. And by the way, I fucking hate animals, especially ones that can kill you.
He hates animals, especially ones that can kill you, yet he's the main protagonist in the film who ultimately, spoiler alert, takes on the croc and triumphs in the end. Ben, also in this film, there's, in some ways, I suppose you might call it a stereotypical engagement with Indigenous Australian culture. There's some music playing at the beginning, and then when they traverse the area of the river that they're not supposed to be in, and Kate sort of signals this by saying, we're not really supposed to go through here, this is sacred land. There's some Australian Indigenous music playing at that point as they motor along, looking at the what appears to be quite a foreboding landscape.
You okay?
Not really supposed to go through here. This is sacred land.
Shouldn't really matter if someone's in trouble, right?
She'll be right.
What's your sense of this ways in which the people in the film are depicted as being out of place in sacred land, Indigenous territory, and the fact that the killer crocodile, the rogue killer crocodile, also inhabits that place?
Sure, yeah. In addition to music, there was also the Indigenous rock art of the crocodile as well. I think at one point when the boat was passing down that particular part of the gully or the canyon.
Yeah, seen through the camera.
Mm.
So there's an extra layer in there, like a tourist view of that painting.
Yeah. It implied to me that seeing that rock art and hearing that quote from the tour guide that they weren't supposed to be there, that the Indigenous people were fully aware of this individual crocodile, respected it, and didn't venture into its territory, in stark contrast to the, say, perhaps naively portrayed tour boat in this case, which of course was responding to the flare. I mean, there's certainly questions to be asked about the characters which we never met, those that were on that first boat which was attacked and presumably perished. But that seemed to be like a small boat. I mean, it could have been tourists that had rented the boats. It could also have been local people living in the Northern Territories that were out for a good time, like Sam Worthington's character, for example. But, you know, why were they there? Why were they not told about, you know, the respect for, you know, Indigenous lands and that sort of thing? So I thought that contrast was quite stark.
And those two antagonists refer to themselves as the wildlife, which is quite interesting, I think.
This is the tour, John. Me and Cole, we're the wildlife.
I mean, another thing I took away from those two characters was how welcome tourists are, in particularly a place where a few years prior there was no tourist activity, there were no tourists. There was a great quote, one of my favourite quotes actually in the whole movie, was from the old bloke that ran the cafe. He was speaking to the journalist, and he exclaimed that, you know, a couple of years ago you wouldn't have seen any tourists in that part, and things change fast.
I'm supposed to catch a boat cruise from here? Or...
Yeah, a few years back, you'd be lucky if you saw any tourists up here at all. Yeah. Too remote for most people. It's changing pretty quickly, I can tell you.
That's an archetype for a lot of ecotourism operations, particularly in the developing world. Not just ecotourism destinations, but tourist destinations more broadly. People cotton onto a place or a particular activity that you can undertake in a place, such as a crocodile-orientated boat tour, and quite quickly local people realise that there's tourist dollars to be made, different entrepreneurs buy a boat, start up competing businesses, and before you know it, you've got a fleet of 40 or 50 boats cruising around a mangrove forest, jet skis, kayak tours, it all follows. And then because of the competition, that's perhaps why some of these tourism companies do resort to the gimmicks. They feed the crocs, or in some cases, they may venture into parts where they're not really supposed to go, where their competitors aren't going, and that gives them a competitive advantage because they might be able to show something or take them to places which the other tours that abide by the rules don't.
And Simon, to return to the killer crocodile in this film, the rogue crocodile, it struck me watching it that in a place such as they are, which I think they say they're in Arnhem Land, I think it was filmed in a mix of Arnhem Land and Kakadu National Park. I've sort of been to that area, and there are crocodiles literally everywhere, yet they seem terrified of just one giant killer croc who seems hell-bent on killing anyone it can get sink its teeth into. What's your sense of why this film needs to rely on the one evil crocodile as part of the plot?
That's a really good question. And I've not been to these parts of the country. I've never seen a crocodile in person. I've only seen crocodiles on screen.
At a safe distance.
Yeah, a very safe distance. You know, the more distance, the safer. Crocodiles in Australia, are perhaps a bit unique in how we conceive of different animal species. I think in general in Australia, we have quite a confused relationship with animals. You know, on the level of culture, we take animals as emblems. We kind of uphold animals. You know, we name national sporting teams after animals at the same time as we're not great at kind of supporting animals to stay alive and species to stay alive and flourishing. And within all of that, crocodiles are one species that tend not to have huge uptake in terms of the kind of emblem. You know, we're not super prideful about crocodiles. We don't in the city see, you know, Australian merchandise with crocodiles all over it, that sort of thing. So crocodiles, especially in the context of horror and monsters, they're a much more like alien species than many of the other species that we encounter and popularly represent in Australia. There's something about them, you know, that they're so far from the human. Looking at, you know, wallabies, koalas, for example, it's very easy to anthropomorphize those animals. Crocodiles, they resist this kind of representation. Perhaps it's to do with the teeth. The teeth represent a kind of violence and a kind of wounding that is pretty unusual. It's pretty shark-like. Also the fact that they're underwater, you know, that puts them at another remove from human realms. So they're at a real distance and they're really extremely alien in that sense.
Mm. And do you know the story of the crocodile that Rogue was based on?
I know that it was named Sweetheart,
I believe.
Sweetheart, sorry. There you go, teeth. I don't know the specifics, but naming a kind of monstrous, murderous crocodile Sweetheart strikes me as a very Australian thing to do.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it was nearly 800 kilograms, 5.1 meters long, and it had reportedly terrorized or sort of nudged some dinghies at a popular Darwin fishing spot, and people apparently had sort of fallen out of the boat. I think this was, you know, many decades ago. People had fallen out of the boat, but no one was actually attacked by Sweetheart, the cuddly crocodile from the top end. But the crocodile was eventually caught in a trap and anaesthetized, and they attempted to remove it. But in doing that, it got stuck underwater and it drowned, which is quite an interesting story, I suppose, about how in the past we've attempted to grapple with these huge and potentially dangerous animals, you know, that are native to Australia. Ben, you've done some work around charismatic megafauna in relation to ecotourism. Does a crocodile count as charismatic megafauna?
Absolutely, Dylan. And I really liked what Simon was saying there. I found it very interesting. I think the animals which we see, you know, in the gift shops, etc., and what a lot of the tours revolve around are species which are endemic to Australia. You know, you can only see them in Australia, and I think that's a huge draw for the Australian economy. I really think there's tourists who will visit Australia primarily to see a koala, and my mother would be one of them. And beyond seeing me, you know, she wasn't leaving Australia without seeing a koala. But yeah, in terms of the charismatic megafauna, which is really a fancy name for large, iconic animals, you know, these are used often as what we term flagship species. And that's where you use one of these animals or the presence of one of these animals in a particular location in, for example, a marketing campaign to support that animal, but also its broader ecosystem. There's an important distinction between crocodiles as an iconic animal and crocodiles is a dangerous animal. My opinion watching Rogue is that most of the people on that tour, and I think I would be the same, wanted to see the crocodile because it's, you know, a magisterial animal. It's, you know, pretty much walked the earth at the same time as the dinosaurs. It's this alien species, almost like Simon said. And they want to see it for those sort of properties, I think, just because it's such a fairly unique animal. They want to get a photo. They want to say they've seen this big, potentially fearsome animal. But I think obviously from the perspective of the movie, the focus is obviously put on the fact that this happens to be a dangerous animal, you know, obviously without which we wouldn't really have had the movie, would we? And it's the same to some extent with sharks, when we think about great white shark cage diving. anacondas in South America. Many people go to South America so that they can get in a line of 10 people and they can hold an anaconda. That anaconda isn't necessarily trying to eat them. But the way these potentially dangerous animals are portrayed in the movies obviously, you know, manifests in society. And I think people's perception, they are obviously dangerous. Are they man or human eating, you know, 24/7? Not necessarily.
I do think it's really noteworthy that in Australian screen culture, crocodiles are an animal against which Australian heroes measure themselves and come to be defined. And of course, I'm thinking of Crocodile Dundee and in a slightly different context, the Crocodile Hunter, these kind of characters who gain their virtues exactly because they can kind of master this dangerous species.
Yeah, and in this film, once again, we see, you know, man gain mastery over the crocodile at the end. What do you make of that, given what we've said about, you know, tourists being in a foreign place in an environment they're potentially not welcome and aren't really supposed to be in? What do you make of that, Simon, the fact that the crocodile ultimately meets its match?
Honestly, for me, watching the film, the way the crocodile goes out, it's a little bit disappointing. Especially because there's such care, really, in the filmmaking about how the crocodile is revealed over the film, and it's not long after we see it in its full fearsomeness that it kind of meets its end against a stick, impaled on a stick. You know, obviously the point is to showcase how resourceful the character is. But yeah, am I alone in that? I found it a little bit disappointing the way this fearsome creature kind of...
I personally would have quite liked it maybe if the crocodile had survived. At the end of the day, it was just defending its territory. It was behaving quite naturally. And, you know, yes, maybe most of the characters could have survived in very much the same way as the movie panned out. But yeah, I'm not sure the crocodile needed to die, especially since it's presumably lived alongside the indigenous people for a good few decades. So I'm not sure if it did aid societal appreciation for certainly crocodiles. I feel like maybe the movie fell into the usual traps which a lot of these animal horror movies do.
I too would have liked to see the crocodile survive, and if it has to die, you know, it would have been nice to see it mourned in some way. I'm sure there are characters in the world of the film who would be mourning the passing of the crocodile, and I don't think the film does much in a broader, larger sense to kind of shift ideas around nature away from this idea of nature being something that is there for humans to showcase our mastery, you know, like a foil for humanity. I think it upholds those ideas really pretty clearly.
Yeah. And what about the role of film in encouraging tourism as well? Because, I mean, you mentioned Crocodile Dundee before. Of course, that was very much made as a film, brought a part of a tourism campaign, and that still has a lot of resonance in places like the US. That you know, caricature of of Paul Hogan in that film has had such resonance. Is there any broader impact you could imagine from films like Rogue continuing to be made, Ben?
I think there's opportunities out there to be a little bit more original, certainly in terms of the animal horror genre. I mean, I remember watching Crocodile Dundee when I was very, very young, and that probably ingrained a few stereotypes about Australia and Australian culture and Australians with me at a very early age, you know? So that's the kind of impression that a movie can have, of course. We've kind of got David Attenborough's wildlife documentaries on one side, and then we've got the sort of the big animal sort of horror movies, and there's not that much really in the middle.
Yeah, and there were opportunities there, as you've mentioned as well. Simon, what's your sense of that? Do you perceive an issue with films playing into these very common stereotypes and encouraging, I suppose, outsider perspectives of Australia, but also encouraging tourism trades based on those images?
Like Ben, I agree that there are positive possibilities out there. Whether or not the industries at hand are poised to kind of make the most of those opportunities, I'm not sure. I have my doubts. I do think that there are probably things out there. And I mentioned Crocodile Hunter before, which probably more than Crocodile Dundee shaped my impression of what Australia was like when I was very young. And of course, it's a documentary context, but that's an example, you know, of screen media that is kind of intermeshes with conservation and, I believe, tourism in some different ways, maybe. Again, I'd echo that idea that the film reflects a disconnect between humans and nature, but more specifically that within that disconnect, there's, you know, a great deal of anxiety and fear. I think the film, like a lot of horror, does a good job of kind of activating thinking about those things, but it doesn't necessarily do it in a super productive way. So it does provoke us to think about things with an almost surprising degree of depth, but it doesn't quite get all the way there in terms of what I'd like to see around, you know, productive understandings of how we might differently, I don't know, I'm always a bit dubious to say reconnect, but maybe find more sustainable, more flourishing, positive ways of imagining and kind of connecting with the environment in Australia.
And in some ways, I suppose what's lacking can be revealing as well, as we've touched on in this conversation. Dr. Ben Thompson, Dr. Simon Troon, it's been so great having your expert insights on this episode of Seeing Green. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks very much, Dylan and Simon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing Green is made at Swinburne University of Technology and Monash University and is supported by an Australian Research Council Discovery Grant. Our executive producers are Professor Therese Davis and Associate Professor Belinda Smale. Production and mixing by Britta Jorgensen. Music by Ash Sterling and hosted by me, Dylan Bird.